You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Coming to you live from Studio One here in London, you're listening to Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
This is a seismically very active zone. The Himalayas are still rising, and Nepal does experience tremors and quakes fairly regularly, but this is very much the biggest one for 81 years. The last was in 1934.
Michael Hutt there, Professor of Nepali and Himalayan Studies at SOAS here in London, speaking on The Briefing earlier today. As the death toll in Nepal continues to rise after the weekend's devastating earthquake, how might the country begin its mission to rebuild? I'll discuss that with my studio guests James Schneider and Jane Kinnamond. Also ahead...
When we conclude the decisive storm operation, we announce that we are still committed to protect civilians and to accompany the political process that the Yemeni government will start.
The Saudis are continuing their assault on Yemen today as claims arise that the warring factions were on the brink of a power-sharing deal when airstrikes began. Plus, diplomatic turmoil between South Africa and Nigeria, and the Islamic State launches its own healthcare service. Just how ridiculous is it? We'll have that and more analysis too. That's all coming on this Monday edition of Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are James Schneider, Editorial Director at New Africa magazine, and Jane Kinnamond, Senior Research Fellow at the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Welcome both to the programme.
Thank you.
Well, international aid agencies are rushing to keep up with the situation in Nepal today as the death toll rises to more than 3,900. Parts of the country have been transformed into makeshift tent cities with more than 7,000 people injured and many thousands more displaced from their homes. But as Nepalese authorities struggle to gain a grip on the country again and begin recovery, questions linger how the earthquake-prone country might protect itself from future disasters. Jane, a terrible tragedy to watch unfolding, and as the numbers continue to tick up. But is there much that a country like this can do? It's an impoverished country where the building standards we've seen are very traditional. They don't certainly have the ability to put up earthquake-proof buildings.
No, absolutely. It's an expensive business, and more advanced countries, more rich countries, I mean, really, like Japan, are able to invest a lot more in early warning systems and disaster response plans. It's much tougher in a place like Nepal, where for government, often the priority is looking to spend money on basic sanitation. Many people there normally don't have good access to water and electricity and so forth. What we may see that's interesting and new in the response is that India and China have been competing recently to put more aid than the other one into Nepal as an attempt to get political influence there. So you may see increasingly these areas where Western donors have tended to dominate, like these sort of disaster preparation systems, actually being funded by the regional superpowers.
James, you know, you may not know Nepal incredibly well, but from your kind of perspective watching these things sometimes unfold in Africa, natural disasters, and what happens in the aftermath. As Jane was saying, you know, there's not much that these countries, impoverished countries, can do, you know, from the get-go. But is it dependent on what outside nations then, you know, come along and help them do? Or do you think these solutions need to be a bit more homegrown?
Well, I think it depends on the situation, and you probably need both. I mean, there are things that poor countries can do to mitigate risk and that partners can do with them. I mean, even in this case in Nepal, it's not as if the government wasn't aware that they were an earthquake risk. My understanding is that they did have preparations in there, and apparently in the capital, Kathmandu, the modern buildings are still standing. And so there are things that can be done with building codes, with things within their resources. But yes, they need to. There needs to be more done from the outside. And I think probably how that should work is that outside partners try to work alongside the priorities of the local country, who can set the parameters for what needs to be done, and then they put in the resources that government requires in both preparation and then in action. You know, if and when something happens.
Jane, you were hinting there that both India and China will kind of, you know, step up to the plate in this instance, you know, maybe for future kind of powers there, as well as what's happening today. But when you look at the Western response, I was quite impressed actually this morning looking at the roll call of people who are already kind of on planes, en route. Even from the UK, they were sending out sniffer dogs who were capable of finding people buried in the rubble. It seems that, you know, post, I think, the tsunami, that actually many of these countries in the West are pretty adept at kind of getting teams together as well. Are you slightly hopeful that, you know, we do know what to do now in these situations?
Well, earthquakes of this kind of magnitude are actually a fairly frequent occurrence. The US Geological Survey has a list online of the earthquakes that have killed more than 1,000 people since 1914, and on average it is about one a year. So the more there can be international experience sharing, the more that some things can be learned, even if they are things that you can't do anything to stop.
James, you want to come back in?
And there was relative preparedness for this. A senior UNDP official a couple of years ago said that this particular earthquake, this happening in the Kathmandu Valley, was the humanitarian emergency that kept him up at night. Mm. And there was lots of planning from humanitarian agencies about what would happen to mitigate the risk. Of course, there could have been more done. But I just want to make one quick point about China, who are playing a big role and will play a big role. But the Chinese Communist Party has a big internal public relations issue to play with delivering humanitarian aid, because the Chinese population, as we saw with Hurricane Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, tends to be quite opposed to the provision of humanitarian aid for disasters and emergencies, because China has, you know, quite a large number of those itself.
Well, the example of the Typhoon Haiyan is interesting. I have the numbers here. 6,300 people died. 4.1 million people were displaced. And Jane, I think that in these instances, what's interesting is not only what happens in the first few days after these events, but I think here, Typhoon Haiyan was an example where they felt that they were a little bit left alone, you know, 2 months afterwards, 6 months afterwards. What's important is, I think, getting aid in that then helps people kind of reconstruct their homes, put their lives back together a little bit.
Well, that's right. The earthquake comes on top of an already very tough economic situation for most Nepalese. So there needs to be thinking about how the reconstruction can feed into something that is a bit more sustainable longer term. Sometimes what can happen is you can have long-term development programs, and then an emergency response comes in from a different agency or a different country, and it's completely unjoined up. Anything that can be done to bridge that would be quite useful.
Well, let's move on, because as the world struggled to understand recently the nature behind the rising tide of violence against migrant workers that's rocked South Africa, a diplomatic rift was also, it seems, simmering. Nigeria's decision to pull its envoy from Pretoria has ignited a terse statement from South Africa, with the government labelling the move an unfortunate and regrettable step and criticising Nigeria for failing to manage the growing threat posed by Boko Haram terrorists in that country's north. James, this is an unseemly spat between two of the most powerful countries in Africa. And does that hint at why there is a bit of a spat? Because each of them would like to see themselves as the kind of the nation leading Africa in some sense.
Yes, that's exactly it. Nigeria and South Africa have pretty poor relations, and this is a symptomatic of that rather than the cause of that, which does come down to rivalry. South Africa wants to play a very outsized role diplomatically in terms of foreign policy, in terms of continental policy, and so does Nigeria, and they push up against each other. And then there's some kind of just machismo in it as well, where Nigeria recently surpassed South Africa as the continent's biggest economy because they rebased their GDP, and South Africans felt quite bad about that. They read about Nigerian very high growth rates, people very interested in investing in Nigeria, looking at Nigeria, and South Africa's economy is pretty anemic and fairly stagnant. And that's the kind of context that this has come out of.
Jane, it kind of also hints at a lack of diplomacy in place, because it's a bit unseemly, isn't it? So suddenly kind of, you know, pulling out your envoys, and then the response from South Africa was hardly gracious either.
I assume here that both sides are looking to their domestic audiences, and that it's got very little to do with really trying to better their diplomacy with the other countries. You know, perhaps it's a quite typical thing for this kind of grandstanding to go down well with your own nationalistic audience back at home.
And do you think there's a lack of leadership here? You know, that if Zuma was a more charismatic leader, had done more over the previous weeks, you know, the likes of Goodluck Jonathan haven't been the most impressive global leaders either. Do you feel that it comes from the top, this kind of failure to kind of, you know, deal with these situations?
I don't know whether it does in this case, but it certainly seems like a classic example of politicians picking on an issue that isn't a core issue, isn't that relevant, and is quite easy to make a bit of noise about, while failing to deal with a whole bunch of other very serious problems they have at home.
James, the South Africans pointed out that a church had collapsed in Nigeria, in which many South Africans lost their lives, and that they had been kind of they suggested that they had been, you know, quiet and contemplative at that moment rather than pointing the finger, and now they're saying, you know, now Nigeria, you know, you're pointing the finger at us in the first instance. You know, do you feel that what do you feel is behind these different sets of circumstances? Do you feel that South Africa is in the right in a way to say, actually, hold on, you know, we've been a little bit more diplomatic in our behaviour?
On the one hand, they're not really comparable situations, but I mean, yes, Nigeria. So they've got kind of plausible deniability because they say they've not withdrawn their envoy and deputy envoy. They've just asked them to come back so that they can be briefed because they can't be briefed over the phone, apparently. And yeah, clearly that is that stokes up fire. That is undiplomatic, and that's caused South Africa's extremely undiplomatic response. But this is also South Africa's response is also part of how the government has changed its tack slightly in how it's responding to this the wave of violence and how it's been responded to by other African states. Zuma just gave a speech in which he, you know, laid out the psychological and economic and social and structural causes of xenophobia and located a lot of those in apartheid and some of the post-apartheid period, which was the correct thing, and then went and said, well, but why are these immigrants here anyway? African states have got to sort themselves out, and we've really got to talk about illegal immigration, and then said something kind of unpleasant about one of the Mozambicans who was killed in the violence. So it does fit into the basic matrix of the South African government's response.
Jane, not just in relation to Nigeria, but do you feel that South Africa has lost a bit of regional leadership over the past few weeks?
I think, as James was saying, Nigeria's economic growth does put some South African noses out of joint, and probably is one of the driving factors that's really underlying this.
But also, when you look at across the border, closer to home, to, you know, Mozambique, to Zambia, it feels that South Africa was once the leader amongst all these nations. It won this, you know, this great battle against apartheid. You know, it had leadership that inspired everybody around them. Do you feel it's both of you that is slipping away from it?
Well, we have to feel slightly sorry for Zuma in that he did have a very hard act to follow. whenever people talk about a dearth of leadership anywhere else in the world, they always say, I wish we had a Mandela.
There has always been, even in the post-apartheid period, a resistance to South African dominance and over-expansion from other African states who remembered the role that South African government, when it was in the apartheid era, played. And Mandela tried to have a very quietist foreign policy for that reason in response. And as time has gone on and South Africa has tried to exert itself a bit more, it has been cast in this, it has been feared, essentially, by other countries who've returned more to the previous mold. So South Africa has not really at any point been able to project a leadership role on the continent, because the period of time when it could have done with Mandela purposely tried to lay the foundations for better relations by not having an exerted foreign policy.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House, here with me, Andrew Tuck, Jane Kinnamont and James Schneider. Coming up, after claims that a power-sharing deal in Yemen was close when airstrikes began, we'll ask whether the military intervention has made everything needlessly worse. I'm Andrew Tuck, and this is Midori House.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, at half an hour is now shorter, sweeter, new and improved. Where else can you end up informed and entertained after half an hour? By watching a quarter of Oscar-winning The Theory of Everything, by reading the first 20 pages of Kazuo Ishiguro's new novel, by speed-walking through a thousandth of the Venice Biennale, not on your Nelly. Culture with Robert Bound, smaller and even more perfectly formed.
This is what people do for a living, right? They put their shows on. This is the show of shows.
Culture premieres at 1900 hours London time on Mondays.
From a 71-year-old barber to a century-old cafe owner, Monocle Films visits Japan's sprightly elderly who are showing little sign of letting up.
For many in this long-living country, the official retirement age is merely a number. Up and down the country, many people in Japan are working well into their 70s and 80s, and sometimes even beyond. 100-year-old Ichiro Sekiguchi says that working has kept him fit. Today, he is still in charge at Café de l'Homme, the coffee house he opened in Ginza in 1948.
Older, wiser, and going strong. Senior Style in Japan, premiering now in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Jane Kinnamont and James Schneider still with me here in the studio, thank heavens. Well, the Saudi-led coalition against Houthi rebels in Yemen is intensifying today as airstrikes continue to pound the country. A former UN official, however, is throwing cold water on claims that the coalition was left with little choice before it began the air offensive. Jamal Ben Ammar was a key part of the UN negotiations until his resignation last week. He told the Wall Street Journal today that a power-sharing deal between all Yemen's political sides was close in the moments before the airstrikes dramatically altered the nature of Yemen's unrest. Jane, do you give any credit to these claims?
Jamal Ben Ammar is a very credible figure. He has been negotiating in Yemen throughout the country's transition since the Arab Spring. He's very familiar with all the Yemeni uprisings. He was the key person negotiating this political agreement. So yes, he knows what he is talking about. Probably what has happened is that Saudi Arabia felt it needed to get involved militarily to redress the balance in Yemen because it believes that Iran was militarily involved on the side of the Houthis.
And you know the region well and you know what's been happening there. Yeah, the idea of a political negotiation, again, he may be right, but it's always been a very hard country to hold together. You know, it was two countries, it was bolted together. It has Al-Qaeda. There are so many elements. You know, we shouldn't kind of trick ourselves that it's just getting people around a table and a nice deal would be presentable, is it?
Many Yemenis have been very proud that the uprising of 2011, which led the army to split, didn't reawaken the country's civil war. And although they have experienced war before, there are also traditions of mediation and compromise, not just at the elite political level, but in terms of the way that the tribes operate with each other. This is a country where there are more arms than people. Everybody is armed. Most of the time, they don't fight.
Jane has hinted that the Saudis wanted to redress the balance a little bit, but the airstrikes don't seem to have got anywhere near a resolution, do they? They seem to have made a terrible situation even more complicated, with nobody willing to kind of back off.
Yes, and the Saudis said that they'd accomplished their mission, they'd degraded the Houthis, but I don't quite see how they could have done, because the Houthis haven't lost territory. They still seem to be in Sana'a, in Aden, and many other parts of the country. And it seems like the effect of Saudi bombing has been to degrade and destroy an already very weak national infrastructure and kill a certain number of people. So it doesn't seem like it's been terribly effective in ending the conflict firmly on one side or the other. And the man whose government they're supposedly supporting is still, I understand, not in Yemen and in the Saudi capital.
Yes.
Jane.
They militarily, what they have been able to do is destroy the military infrastructure that belongs to the former president, Saleh. Some of the factions from the army were still loyal to him, so they brought arms, often bought from the US, over to the side of the Houthis. That was something the Saudis could take out from the air. But politically, one of the aims has been to reinstate President Hadi. They keep flagging that he is internationally recognised and therefore legitimate. However, it seems that his domestic stature is diminishing because he's sitting in Riyadh praising airstrikes, which many Yemenis are suffering from. So there are people who supported him before the airstrikes who now think that the Houthis are a better bet.
And Jane, do you think that the Saudis, you know, do you think they did jump the gun, as it were? Do you think they moved too fast? Do you think they could have done anything else?
It depends what the key goal is. Probably Yemen itself would have been better served by the political process continuing. But unfortunately, the conflict has become part of the regional competition for influence. And the timing is tied in also to the nuclear deal with Iran.
James, do you think that this is going to have a much of a consequence for Africa? We've seen many people kind of leaving, heading across to Djibouti, heading across the Horn of Africa. What are the consequences for Africa?
Yeah, I think it does in two ways. One, yes, with the refugee flow to both Djibouti and to Somalia. Somalia now importing refugees rather than exporting. But then the other one is Sudan. So Sudan was allied to Iran and was part of something called the Red Sea Alliance. And they sometimes linked up with arms with Hezbollah, and it was a kind of peculiar anomaly, but it was there. And they've swapped sides fundamentally, and they joined the military campaign against the Houthis, and have now signed up to an alliance with Saudi Arabia because they're cash strapped and they're looking for money. So there is some effect happening in Africa.
And Jane, just finally on this, how much of a proxy war do you feel is being fought here? Do you think the Saudis would have moved ahead if they hadn't got the nod from Washington and the West? Do you feel that it really is a kind of trying to draw a line to stop Iranian influence, as you said? How much of a proxy war is this?
There is some difference here, I think, between the US and Saudi Arabia. I think the US shares the goal of supporting President Hadi. They want to contain the Houthis, but they're also very worried about the risk that Al-Qaeda in Yemen could, in fact, be the main beneficiary of this. Whereas for Saudi Arabia, Iran and the Houthis are even bigger enemies of theirs than Al-Qaeda. So they're not entirely on the same page, but certainly Saudi Arabia needs American arms. They would not act unilaterally if they thought that the US would have a serious objection to it.
And finally, Jane, before we move on, do you feel that there's kind of any end goal in here? So if the Saudis take a step back, even if we can get people back to a negotiating table, do you feel it's potentially too late now for Yemen to go back to being one nation? Mm-hmm. There are many people now who seem to be talking, you've said that they avoided the civil war, but there are many people who seem to be saying, actually, it's so tribal now, it would be easier if the country was split back into two.
There is a high risk that civil war could re-emerge. One of the things that could be an alternative to that would be that if you did resume a political process, there'd probably have to be some kind of quite radical decentralisation to give the different regions, including the south, more decision-making powers. But that's something that the Arab world is traditionally very poor at. It's been dominated by centralised states for so long.
Well, let's move on to our final subject for today. As we've come to expect, the arrival of a video from Islamic State militants usually signals a horrible new chapter in the terrorist group's spread of violence. But the latest instalment of fear-mongering propaganda by the group takes a decidedly different turn, with glossy graphics and a familiar logo. The so-called Islamic State appears to have launched its own health service in a video that seems to have been filmed in Raqqa General Hospital. An apparently Australian doctor speaks glowingly of X-ray facilities, the intensive care unit, and even a women-only ward. James, this video seems to be trying to present a different image of that we've seen of Islamic State. Of course, you know, the beheadings are all very well and good for your political faction, for putting the fear of God into people. But in the end, they're dependent also on people wanting to move to Raqqa, wanting to sign up to the movement. Do you think this is an attempt to present to their own audience a more, or potential recruits, a more kind of human face?
It is, but they were doing this sort of thing before. Part of Islamic State's propaganda and self-image is that they can commit these incredible acts of violence, which perhaps signal some kind of end days, and that would bring people to them and assert their authority. But also that the space that they control is governed properly Islamically. That's what they say. And the upshot of that is meant to be social welfare. It's meant to be benefits for the general population. So that's one of the things that they were stressing before the airstrikes against them started. And, if you judging by the reporting of people who were planning to go to the area controlled by the Islamic State from neighbouring countries, so some reporting out of Turkey, for example, people there had heard that in the Islamic State they had very good education for children and they had swimming pools for children as well. Now, this, may be total nonsense, but they had heard this from somewhere. So whilst this particular, aping the NHS's logo and the glossy video on this particular fact might be new, the idea that the Islamic State are trying to put forward that they are also a government and they can provide for people isn't new.
Jane, it doesn't seem to be much connected with reality either. They may be good at producing videos that, and maybe some people are taken in by that, but from what we've seen from people who have left Raqqa, who have talked about what the situation is like in the city, it seems that there's an elite of foreign fighters who may be still getting all the things they need during a day. But that city, from every other report, seems to be on its knees in many senses. Do you feel this is just a piece of glossy PR that has really no connection with reality?
Well, I think there's something in it, in that they are seeking to provide some state-like functions in parts of Syria where the central government no longer has any writ, and that ultimately there'll be some people that are drawn to them for ideological reasons, but there will be others who think that they are the lesser of two evils and that even these guys might be better than pure chaos. Typically, groups like this, they try to offer some measure of lawfulness, even if it is very extreme and brutally enforced. That can seem attractive. For instance, people in Afghanistan have sometimes seen the Taliban as useful because they bring some measure of order, even if it's viciously enforced.
James, what do you make of their use of the likes of YouTube? Do you feel that these it must be galling for all the authorities who are trying to clamp down on recruitment, whether in Paris or in London, and to see these videos go up again and again and again. Do you feel that actually this is the key battleground that they're winning in?
Well, I think that the actual battleground that most matters is still the one that has the bombs and the bullets and so on. That's where the war is really won. But there's only so much that authorities can do about pretty much open information platforms, which we want and we can't have shut down. And all they can try to do is cull the information from that and inform themselves better about the group. I think trying to just play whack-a-mole and try to shut down any accounts as soon as it opens up doesn't seem to work, because more emerge so easily.
And Jane, what's your take on their use of social media? They seem to be the most skilled in comparison to any other kind of terror group. They know not only kind of how to use it as recruitment, but kind of how to kind of irritate the opposition as well. In the West, as I said, these videos are just so difficult for the authorities to counter.
And they are produced in a very watchable way. I mean, they use a lot of Western skills and training, I think, to produce them. They're seen as being very watchable and almost entertaining. It's a capacity that Al-Qaeda didn't really have. Al-Qaeda and similar groups did all these things with beheading videos before, but they didn't get them watched by such a large number of people. And the international media plays into it to some extent by rebroadcasting these things and giving them the oxygen of publicity.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Jane Kinnamon and James Schneider, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. That's all we have time for today. Today's show was produced by Ben Rylan. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mike Hune. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Ben Rylan will be keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. Then at 1900 hours, it's Tom Morris with Section D, our design show. And at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. The show, well, it's going to be back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck, and thank you very much for listening.